Well, good to see you this evening. We're in Matthew chapter 20. We'll begin in verse 17. As we go through the scriptures, just chapter by chapter, here in the Gospel of Matthew, as he's telling us about the life and teaching of Jesus, sometimes it may seem like, well, didn't we study that already? And in some cases, we have talked about it before because Jesus talked about it before. There are certain themes that Jesus keeps coming back to. I think the reason he keeps coming back to them is probably because, first of all, they're important. Did you ever do that with your children? You told them the things that were important over and over again? I think Jesus told his disciples the things that were important more than one time. He repeated it. He told them in a different way. He told it with a story, a parable, to try to help them understand it better. He would reinforce it sometimes with a miracle. He wanted them to understand. And so he would repeat those things that were the most important. But also, I think, not only were they the things that were most important, but they were also the things that were most misunderstood. They were the things that people had the wrong idea about. And so in order to get his followers, his disciples, to see things his way, he had to keep pounding that same message in. And we have some things like that in our world today. Certainly the world views things different than Christians do, or certainly different than Christians should. And so we have to, with our children, with someone who's a new convert, with someone who is, you know, trying to learn more about being a Christian, we have to go again and again sometimes some of the same things. And so Jesus does that time and again. There are several times that he touches on the same themes. Some of the things that he talked about in the Sermon on the Mount way back in chapters 5, 6, and 7 have popped up again, haven't they? He's talked about them again. He's taught more about those subjects that in that lesson he just kind of brushed over them a little bit and mentioned them maybe for a verse or two, but then later maybe he tells a parable that's 30 verses long about that particular issue. And so Jesus wants us to understand these things. He wants us to know how to view life, and particularly with so many, as with the parables and so much of his teaching, what is the kingdom like? How does he want the church to be? How does he want his followers to live? And that's what's really important, isn't it? If we're going to follow Jesus, we need to know, how should we live? How should the church be? What's the kingdom like? So that we can know, well, you know, we've got this right, or maybe we've got this wrong, and we need to correct that. And so we can see that as he describes that. And of course, last time that we were together a couple of weeks ago, I almost said a couple of years ago. Sometimes it seems like it's that long. But a couple of weeks ago when we were together in the first part of chapter 20, he told the story about the workers in the vineyard. And you remember we looked at that parable that he told there. And he talked there about the last shall be first and the first shall be last. That was the way he ended it in verse 16. Of chapter 20. Well then, as we start verse 17, what's interesting is Jesus is now going up to Jerusalem. This is his last trip. This is the home stretch. Now he'll do some traveling around the Jerusalem area, but he's not going back to Galilee again. This is it. This is the last time before his death. And so here we are, chapter 20. We've got still a few chapters left in Matthew, but he's making that final trip to Jerusalem before his death. And he, of course, takes the 12 with him. And the last thing, remember, that he has taught, that we have a record of here, was this about the last being first and the first being last. And then, on top of that teaching now, as they're traveling along, and you can just imagine them, you know, we talk in the car. Maybe you talked in the car with somebody on the way here tonight. Maybe you were alone and didn't, you know. But somebody, you know, they walked where they went. And they would walk along talking about what was going on. But here they are walking along, and Jesus is telling them what's going to happen. In verse number 18, He says, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man is going to be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes." Now, of course, He talked to them before about His coming death. But He says here, He's going to be betrayed. It's not just that the chief priests and the scribes and Pharisees are going to come and take Him by force. Someone's going to betray Him. And of course, He knows who it is. The disciples are still a little clueless at this point. We know who it is too. We know it's Judas Iscariot that's going to do that. But He's going to be betrayed to the chief priests and scribes, and they are going to condemn Him to death, Jesus says. They are going to find Him guilty of some crime that they say deserves for Him to die. But they're not going to do the deed themselves. Under the law of Moses that was in effect at the time that Jesus and the disciples were living, if the Jews executed someone for a violation of the law, how did they do it? Well, they stoned them to death. Was Jesus stoned to death? No, He wasn't stoned to death. There were certain rare cases, like as in the case of a witch, where after they stoned them to death, they burned them with fire on top of it to make sure they were good and dead. But He wasn't burned with fire either. In fact, He says in verse number 19, they are going to deliver Him to the Gentiles to mock Him and to scourge and to crucify Him. So, the Jewish leaders aren't going to do the deed themselves. They're going to get a hired hand to do it. They're going to take Him to the Gentiles and get the Gentiles to do it. But He says, the third day He shall rise again. This is not the first time Jesus has told them that He's going to die or that He's going to rise again. Again, why does He keep repeating these things? Number one, it's important. And number two, they still don't understand it. And so He keeps having to repeat these things. In fact, this particular thing with this and the kingdom that we're fixing to talk about in the coming verses, they seem to still not understand even after His resurrection. They still haven't got it. So, there's still more that they need to learn. In fact, in John, Jesus on the night of His betrayal, as He's talking with them, He says, "There is so much more I want to tell you, but you can't handle it right now. You aren't able to bear it right now." And in fact, Jesus didn't get to fully tell them everything that they needed to know. The Holy Spirit had to come to the apostles and guide them into all truth. The Holy Spirit had to come and reveal some more to them that Jesus was unable to share with them while He was on the earth. Well, here in verse 20 then, now think about what He's just talked about the last couple of times here. He talked about the first shall be last and the last shall be first. He talked about, I'm going to Jerusalem and they're going to kill me there. And so James and John and their mother show up at this point. Their mother, the mother of Zebedee's children, which would be James and John, the sons of Zebedee, their mother comes. And she comes and she worships Jesus and then she asks Him for a favor. Now, I'm guessing that she didn't hear the conversations that they've just been having. If she did, this is really inexcusable what she does. But maybe she didn't catch it. But her sons should have known better. Maybe they were embarrassed by her coming and doing this. Most boys, especially when they come to be men, are kind of embarrassed to have their mommy come and take up for them. Can you imagine on the job, your mommy coming and asking your boss for a favor? Well, even women don't want their mommy to have to come to their job and ask their boss for a favor for them. I'm a grown-up. I can take care of myself. But James and John's mother comes. And he says then to her, what do you want? What is it you... Now, of course, again, how many times when Jesus asks somebody the question, does He already know the answer? Every time. He knows what's in man. He knows their thoughts. He knows what they're going to ask before they ask it. But he asks to get it out of her. What do you want? and her request, "Let my two sons sit on your right hand and the other on your left hand in your kingdom." Well, that's not much of a request, is it? Let my sons be number one and number two in your kingdom. Let them be in those positions of high authority. Let them be your right-hand man and your left-hand man. Let them be your chief lieutenants. Now, she doesn't really understand what she's asking. How many times do people ask for things not knowing what they are really asking for? We talked this morning in our Bible class a little bit about that song, Thank God for Unanswered Prayers, a country song. And this kind of fits right up. She doesn't know what she's asking for those boys. Jesus has just told what He's going to do. He's going to go die. You really want your sons to be on the right hand and the left hand? When Jesus died, when He brought, you know, His glory, who got to be on His right hand and His left hand? A couple of thieves in that case. But she doesn't understand what she's asking, and He realizes that. And He says so in verse 22. He says, "You don't know what you are asking." You don't know. Oh, how many times did we ask God for something, thinking that it was just what would be best for us, but it wasn't. And we didn't know what we were asking. Sometimes God gets tired of folks bugging Him, and sometimes He lets them have what they think they want. Do you remember the children of Israel when they wanted a king? "Let us have a king so we can be like the nations around us. Everybody else has got a king. Why can't we have one?" And what did God do finally? He said, "Okay, you can have your king. But let me tell you what the king is going to do to you. He's going to take your sons to be soldiers. He's going to take your daughters to be his wife and his servants and his baker. He's going to take your children to be bakers and cooks and all these, you know, all these servants for him. Your sons are going to die in war because you, you know, that's what's going to happen when you have a king. Your king's going to tax you and take your money." "Oh, we want a king! We want a king! We want a king!" It wasn't very long before they started wishing they didn't have a king. Kings did just exactly what God said they would do to them. And so bad it got that by the fourth king, Rehoboam, 10 of the 12 tribes rebelled against him and split off to form another nation. Did they return back to God? No. Unfortunately, they just picked their own king to go after, Jeroboam. And he was worse than the other ones had been. But isn't that something, how we think we know what's best for us? Children are the same way. They think they know what's best for them. They don't know. They don't have any idea. I remember when I was young and I thought I knew what was best for me and I didn't have a clue. Sometimes I still don't know what's best for me. And maybe you don't either. But Jesus says, you just don't know what you're asking. Fortunately for these boys, Jesus doesn't give that request. But He says to them, "Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? Can you be baptized with the baptism that I'm going to be baptized with?" They said, "Yeah, we can do it." Well, you've got to admire their courage and boldness, even if it's a little bit of foolishness mixed in there. "Yeah, we can do it." Did they not hear what Jesus just said He was going to Jerusalem to do? Going to die. I'm going to be mocked and scourged and crucified. You want to come? That's what they're, you know, yeah, we can do it. Now maybe they're thinking of some other cup and some other baptism. Maybe they think of water baptism here. Maybe they're confused. But for whatever reason, they're gung-ho. They're ready to go. But Jesus knows they're not quite ready just yet. He says, "Well, you will drink this cup, and you will be baptized with this baptism. It's going to happen to you." And it did. James was the first martyr of the apostles. He was beheaded by Herod. He drank the cup. He was baptized with the baptism. Peter and John. John was with Peter when he was taken in and scourged for preaching about Jesus. Not in the Scriptures, but according to tradition, they say that John was actually dipped in boiling oil, but that miraculously he survived. I don't know. I mean, it could have been. The Bible certainly says they're going to be bit by snakes and drink deadly poison and all these things, and it won't hurt them. John could have been dipped in boiling oil and he survived if God had wanted him to do that. We know he was exiled to the Isle of Patmos all alone. We know he suffered a great deal, just as others did. So these two did drink of some of the sufferings, just as Christ had promised. But you know, Jesus says, I can't give you what you're asking for because it's not mine to give. Wow. You mean Jesus wasn't going to get to choose who was on his right and left in his kingdom? No, he wasn't. He said the Father has prepared who's going to get to do that. The Father's already got that lined up. And I can't change it. You know, it is amazing to me how many people think that they can just pick and choose whatever they want to do. Well, it's my life. I'll live it how I want to live it. It's not your life. It belongs to God. You can either do it His way or you can suffer the consequences. Jesus always chose to do the Father's will. He always chose to do what was right. We don't always choose to do what is right. And we suffer the consequences when we choose the wrong path. But Jesus said, I can't grant that request. That's beyond my power. Now, we wouldn't think that anything would have been beyond Jesus' power. But while He was here on earth, He had limited Himself. He had emptied Himself of certain aspects of His God-like nature, and the Bible tells us He had given up equality with God to become a man. Now that doesn't mean that He's not now God and that He's not now equal with the Father. It doesn't mean that He wasn't deity when He was on the earth either, but just that He had given up some of that equality. You remember when He said, no man knows of the day or the hour, but the Father only. Neither the Son, not the angels, nobody. He didn't even know when He's going to come back. That's over in Matthew 24. He didn't know while He was on this earth. I would imagine He probably does know now. But while He was on this earth, He had forbidden Himself that knowledge. And that was part of the arrangement. The Godhead, before creation began, sat there and made some determinations of how things were going to be. And they determined before mankind was even created that the Father was going to be the revealer that was going to stay in heaven. The Spirit was going to reveal pieces of the plan along the way through the prophets. And then Jesus, the Son, was going to come in the form of Jesus. That Son was going to come. He was going to live on this earth and He was going to be the one that was going to be sacrificed. And then the Spirit was going to continue to reveal the truth to the apostles. And they had already determined some of those things back then. And Jesus can't change that now. It's been set in stone. They've already said that's what's going to happen and that's the way it's going to be. But He couldn't decide to let them do that. Now when the other disciples heard what's going on with James and John, they're just a tad bit upset. Okay, maybe a little more than a tad bit. The King James says that they were had indignation. That's a real fancy way of saying they were hopping mad at those two. They just couldn't believe the audacity of going up and just asking Jesus if you can be number one and number two. And this isn't the only time the disciples have had these arguments about who's number one. And so again, Jesus has to go back and let's cover this again. He has to deal with them like they're a bunch of squabbling little children. Like a bunch of little toddlers fighting over a toy. And here they are, the grown men. And they are the 12 that He's chosen to be His representatives here on earth after He's gone. How disheartening must that have been? He's about to go to Jerusalem to die, and the men that He's chosen to be teachers and witnesses for Him and to testify to others about Him are acting like 2- and 3-year-olds, arguing and fussing and fighting. Well, you know, we can still, you know, but age doesn't necessarily bring maturity. We should be like Paul, who said, when I was a child, I did these childish things, but when I became a man, I gave up childish things. But you know, a lot more people today, and the disciples in that day too, are more like the old Toys R Us slogan, I don't want to grow up. I just want to be a Toys R Us kid. We don't want to grow up. We don't want to take the responsibility and have the maturity that comes with that. We just want to still be kids and play and be immature. But God calls on us to have a level of maturity. And we need to have that. Jesus tries again to help them understand the unusual way His kingdom works. It's not like the rest of them. And He tells them, in the kingdoms around the world, might makes right. Whoever has the authority, they lord it over everybody else, and they, you know, they rule with the iron fist. And if you disagree, we'll into the dungeon with you or off with your head. Authority is always a matter of force, and whoever has the mightiest power rules over everybody else that's weaker than them. But He says in verse 26, things are going to be different in His kingdom. His followers aren't supposed to be like the rest of the world. We're not supposed to be looking for the glory and the power and the might and who's number one. No, He says, instead, in His kingdom, serving is what makes you great. Not how many people serve you, but how many people do you serve? That's what makes you great. Someone is going to be great in Jesus' kingdom. He actually says, let that person be the waiter. That's what the Greek word, diakonos. It's translated a lot of times deacons. In this passage, it's translated as minister. But diakonos literally means a waiter. Let them be the waiter. Let them be the serving person. Hey, boy, come here. Hey, you, I need my drink. That waiter, that's supposed to be our position if we want to be great in God's kingdom. He goes further than that. In fact, He says in verse number 27, He uses an even stronger word. He uses the word doulos. The doulos is translated servant in the King James, but literally it's a slave. It's not a servant who just chooses to serve in a certain capacity to get paid. It's someone who is a bond servant. In other words, they've been bound. They aren't a servant by choice. And He says, you want to really be number one in My kingdom? You be a slave. Serve. It's not how high we can reach to get the greatest gifts that God has to offer. It's how low can we go to reach the greatest gifts that God has to offer. His kingdom is opposite of the way the rest of the world views things. And that's hard to wrap our minds around because we've grown up living in a world that rewards, hey, the more money, the more power, the more people you have under you, the more employees or the more people you manage, you're really getting up there then. And Jesus said, it's not like that. It's how many people can you serve? And so see what James and John were really asking and what their mother was really asking for was for them to get to be the slaves of everybody else. Because that's what it would take to be number one and number two in God's kingdom, is to be servant to the rest. And then Jesus points out in verse number 28 that even He, the Son of Man, He didn't come so that people could serve Him. We think about Jesus' life. Born in that little stable. Not even having a place to lay His head as a grown man. He didn't have a house. He didn't have anywhere to live, even. Didn't have anything but the clothes on His back. Now, you know, God could have laid the plan out so that Jesus was born to Caesar and grew up in Caesar's household and had everybody just fawning all over Him. He could have planned it that way. He could have planned for Jesus to come at a different time and maybe been born into the household of Pharaoh and lived and been the Pharaoh of Egypt. Or He could have been born to Nebuchadnezzar and been king over all Babylon. But that wasn't the plan. Because Jesus didn't come to be served by everybody else. He came to do the serving. And to go so far as to sacrifice His own life to buy others out of slavery. He didn't come so others could sacrifice themselves for Him. He came to sacrifice Himself for them. You see, that's a little opposite of the way most leaders work. Most leaders, when they go to war, they get soldiers and send the soldiers to protect them, don't they? But not Jesus. He was the first one into battle. He was the one that went into battle and died in the battle and rose again and gained the victory in the battle. That was Jesus. He didn't send anybody else in to do it for Him. Didn't send any of the angels to do it for Him. He came and did it Himself. They left Jericho, still heading for Jerusalem, still heading for Jesus' death as it's coming up. And of course, as usual, a big crowd's following Him. And two blind men sitting by the side of the road hear that Jesus is coming, and they start crying out, "Have mercy on us, Lord, the Son of David." Now we might think "Lord" is the significant phrase there, but it's not. "Son of David" is the significant phrase. "Lord" was just a common type of terminology that they used in that day. Like we would say, "Sir," excuse me, "Mister." That's all they were saying there. But when they said "Son of David," that added some emphasis to that "Lord." It wasn't just any "Sir." It was the Messiah, the Son of David, the one who had come to rule on the throne. They recognized Him as the Messiah. They were blind, but they could see it. All the scribes and Pharisees could see, but they were blind to it. It's interesting what James says. He says, "Have you not noticed that there aren't many who are rich in this world that are called, not many who are wise and influential and powerful, not many of those that are great according to this world's standards that are called to the kingdom of Christ." That's what James says about it later. You know, I think he learned something from this experience. He realized it wasn't about being number one. It was just about being one of Jesus' followers, one of Jesus' servants. Well, they call on Him, "Have mercy on us, have mercy on us." The crowd tries to shut Him up. They don't want to be quiet, be quiet. Don't bother Him. "And who are you anyway? You're just a couple of blind beggars. Leave Him alone. He's got more important people like us to see." Well, they just cried out the louder. They just cried out the more, "Have mercy on us, have mercy on us." And, you know, Jesus, what would it have been like to have met Him? To have seen Him walking down that road. But He stops what he's doing. But this huge crowd of people, and some of them may have been wealthy, and some of them may have been influential, and some of them may have been politicians of the day, and some of them may have been religious leaders, and he had his own 12 disciples right there with him. But he stopped all of that to go talk to these two blind beggars over here on the side of the road. See, Jesus didn't think that one soul was more valuable than another soul. Everybody's got a soul, and every soul is a valuable soul that God wants to see in heaven and that Jesus wants to see in heaven. So he comes over to them and he asks them what they want. Amazing, isn't it? Even here he is, he's on his way to go to Jerusalem to die, and he still has time to have compassion on somebody else who's suffering. How many of us, if we knew that, you know, in a couple of weeks or whatever, we're gonna die, how many of us would just be entirely selfish? We wouldn't care about anybody else or anything else. This is all the time I've got. I'm gonna spend it on me. A lot of people would. But not Jesus. Here he is on his way to the grave, and he stops to talk to these two blind beggars. They want their eyes open so they can see. Now they don't ask, "Lord, let me be number one in your kingdom." No. You see, they have a simpler perspective. Here they are. They recognize him as the Messiah, and they just want some mercy. If we'd quit fighting over position and popularity and prestige and just look to God for some mercy, that's what we really need, just like these two. What a simple request. Well, simple. I know I couldn't fulfill it, could you? But simple for the Messiah. And Jesus touches them, and immediately. Didn't take a couple of weeks or anything like that. Didn't have to go take medicine for a while. Didn't have salve they had to put in their eyes. Didn't have to go have surgery. He just touched them and immediately they could see. But you know what they did after he healed them? They got up and they followed him. Has Jesus healed you? Did he heal you from your sin-sick existence? Has he cleansed your sin-sick soul? Are you following him now? If not, why not? How far would you follow him? I don't know who these two blind men are, but boy, they sure started following Jesus after he helped them to see. But you see, they already could see. They could see some spiritual truths that others were missing, even though they had eyesight. Jesus has healed everyone who's a Christian. But are we following him? Are we squabbling over who's going to be the most prestigious, who's going to have first place, who's going to be the most popular, who's going to be number one, who's going to get to do this or do that? Or are we just excited about being one of his? About the fact that we belong to him, that we are his bond servants. And we have a bond holding us to the Lord. A bond of blood, his blood that he shed on the cross, and a bond of water, our baptism, that connected us to that blood. What a bond. How could we do anything but serve him with the rest of our lives after what he has done for us? If you have a need to respond to God's invitation tonight for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.